This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Pamela Adlon, is the co-creator, director, co-writer, and star of the FX comedy series Better Things. She plays Sam Fox, who, like Adlon, is raising three girls as a single mother while also helping her aging mother, who lives next door, and trying to keep her acting career alive. Two of Pamela Adlon's daughters are now teenagers. The other is 21. Adlon has been acting since she was 9. She won an Emmy for her voice work as Bobby Hill, the son in the series King of the Hill, and appeared on 7 seasons of the TV series Californication. She had a long collaborative relationship with Louis C.K. on his show Louie and on his earlier show Lucky Louie. He and Adlon co-created the series Better Things, but she severed ties after he was accused of sexual misconduct by several women and he admitted it was true. We'll talk about that a little later. Let's start with a clip from the new season of Better Things. Adlon's character, Sam, is being examined by her doctor when she starts telling him how stressed out she is by all the mom stuff she has to take care of. And the doctor says, "Oh, like errands? Just let go of it. Everyone's got errands." Here's her response.
No. Errands are like groceries and going to the post office. Mm-hmm. The real mom stuff. Yeah. Soccer club signups and dance classes and tutors and tuition payments and parent-teacher conferences and schools and camps that I have to get them into and mean girl issues with my youngest at school and birth control with my oldest and cruelty from my middle daughter. And then there's my own mom who is driving me nuts, and I'm pretty sure she has a mental something disorder. And my middle daughter is hitting puberty hard. Mm-hmm. And I am definitely going through menopause, yet I still get my period, and I have a beard and 2 mortgages. So yeah, Dr. Babu, it's like, it's a lot. And some mornings I just,
oh my God,
you know, lay in bed in my room and I stare at the ceiling and I just say, I just can't do it anymore. I just can't. So anyway, could you please just give me some Xanax or Ativans or Ambiens or something? Anything you think that'll help me get a full night's sleep, because that's what I really need, Birju. I need a full night of sleep.
Pamela Adlon, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on season 3 of Better Things.
Thank you so much, Terry.
So this season, everyone is going through a change. Like you said, you know, your oldest is going to college, the middle's in puberty, your youngest is being bullied at school. Your character's mother seems to be in the early stages of dementia. Your character's going through menopause. Are these the personal issues you've been dealing with?
You know, I say this about my show, that it's an exaggerated version of my life. So it's like Sam Fox is me in a cape. You know, certainly I'm in a multi-generational situation with all women in my life. My 3 daughters live at home. My mother lives next door. I'm what I think they call the sandwich generation. And so these issues are all happening to me to a certain extent right now. My own mother isn't going through dementia, but it's an interesting place to go. And I like people to have their own interpretation. And I think that's why people take this show so personally, because everybody's going through some version of these different things.
I think women over the years have been very uncomfortable talking about getting older, maybe because I think a lot of women feel devalued with age and they're no longer considered sexual. So how did you feel about putting it out there, about crossing the threshold of 50?
It's so exciting to me, because I didn't say my real age for years, you know, and
why not?
Because of the taboo of it, and you know, when people find out, especially being an actor in the industry, it hurts you. For a woman, you hit that 40, you know, it affects you because it is such an ageist, sexist industry, which I think is now shifting and changing. It's still not 100% yet, but it's the irony is not lost on me that my father, at he hit 50, and basically, you know, he was a writer and producer, and the jobs kind of started drying up for him because people wanted younger people. They want young blood, and they valued youth over, you know, ability even. And so then I turn 50 and I have my own show, and all of a sudden it's a whole new world for me professionally, you know, with all the different jobs that I do. And my show is a wonderful, I love my show. It's beautiful. I can tell these stories in an artful, cinematic way. It has great music, great actors. But also my show is the story about me and how I know that people are excited. You know, this lady's been kicking around in this business since I'm 9 years old, and she hits it big at 50.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the things that bother you most and some of the things you find most liberating about having turned 50 a few years ago?
You know, only two.
2 years ago, okay.
See, it's still
two
sensitive.
Yes, I see.
You know, it's just, you kind of, when you get comfortable with yourself, it's a way of feeling confident and not having to hurry up and catch up and measure up to other people. When you let go of that, the power is incredible. If you look for things that are, you know, that if somebody's giving you a side eye and you think they don't like you or anything like that, you look in the mirror and you're like, oh, I guess this is my neck now. Okay, well, let's keep going with that. Or are these jowls? Is this what you would call jowls? That's so interesting. Oh, arm cellulite. That's fun. That's fun. You know, so it's like, you know, you have the physical things, but those things don't matter because your mind is richer, your experiences are richer, your life is deeper, your connections with your friends are deeper. My kids are older now, and our relationships are so much deeper than they used to be. You know, I used to try to get as far away from my kids as I could when they were younger. And now I want them around me all the time, and they want that too.
So in the opening of the first episode, your character's trying on clothes and none of them fit because your character has put on a few pounds. So it seems like you've put on a few pounds. So I think in that opening scene, there's maybe a few extra pounds than there really were.
No, that's all me, Terry.
Okay, all right. So was that stress eating? Because this has been such a difficult time with you doing so much to get the show done.
You know what? It's very interesting because I wrapped season two of my show and I went into the editing room and, you know, just a few months went by. My body changed. You know, I got thicker and I don't feel bad about my body or anything, but it was shocking. And I remember being in my closet and trying on pants. I'm like, I just wore these 3 months ago. And things were just tighter. And it was a moment that I thought, oh boy, I'm going to have to do this in my show. because it's, you know, you get into your 50s, your metabolism does funky things. And, you know, I decided that it would be a very generous thing for me to do it, to kind of illustrate it in my show so everybody doesn't feel so alone. Because, you know, that happened to me, and you sit there and you're by yourself. And for people, women in particular, when our bodies don't measure up to what our idea is of what we're supposed to look like with our clothes off in the mirror, that's a shocking thing. You know, it's not our fault, and it's not up to us to maintain some kind of a physical image for anybody but ourselves.
I like the fact that when your character realizes her clothes no longer fit her because she's put on a few pounds, she doesn't go like, so I'm going on a diet now, and I will lose that weight. My goal will be to fit back in these clothes. I mean, she goes about her life.
Interesting.
You know?
Yeah.
And also, you as the star of the show and also the director of the show, you don't have somebody else telling you, Pamela Adlon, if you're going to continue playing this role, you have to lose some weight. No one's telling you that. It's your show.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Isn't that amazing?
That's good.
Also,
right?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't gain that much weight. But,
no, I know. I know.
I'm kidding. But listen, I remember being a teenage actor and being on a show. I'm not going to say the name, but I remember some girls on the show being pressured to lose weight. And it was extremely inappropriate, and it was extremely damaging, you know, to the psyche of a young girl. I mean, that was, you know, being in the 80s, in 80s television, that would be the ultimate era of toxic trying to control the way women are portrayed.
Louis C.K. co-created the show with you and was a co-writer with you on the first two seasons. And you parted ways with him after several women went public saying he'd masturbated in front of them, and then he admitted it was true. After those women went public and Louis C.K. Confessed to it, you thought of stopping the show because he'd been such a key part of it. Why did you think maybe you should stop, and why did you think that you were going to continue anyways?
My personal feelings about what had happened, you know, me trying to wrap my mind around, you know, this cataclysmic event that happened and was directly affecting how do I keep making this show, you know? I mean, he was my consigliere when I was doing it. You know, I mean, I make this show in California. He lives in New York. We were able to talk out the stories and make the show together. And so we did that for two seasons. So he gets stripped of his executive producer credit. But, you know, we are co-creators of this show. And there's his name. So I say, what do I do? Do I call it Schmetter Schmings? Do I call it Mo Better Things or something and like make a new show? I just could not wrap my mind around how I could continue this professionally. And, you know, it was a whopper. I had to take a knee for some time. The fact that women were hurt by him and that he came out and he talked about it, we were all scratching our heads. I remember, you know, talking to my daughters about it. And I remember thinking about his daughters. And it was just, you know, in general, it was a lot. So I did not know how to kind of put my feet forward, one in front of the other.
So what did you change so that you could move forward?
Well, I was given the go-ahead by the head of my network, who's the incredible John Landgraf. But, you know, there was just a certain point that he called me and he told me some other weird, bad news about, you know, we weren't going to be considered for any awards season things. And it was just, we were being affected by this thing.
Because Louis was affiliated with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I just said to him at a certain point, I said, this doesn't really make sense anymore. I don't think that I can do this show anymore. I don't think that my heart's in it. I don't know how to keep moving forward. And he said, I'm not going to force you to do anything, but I want you to do your show. I want to see your show. I want you to keep doing your show. And he said, just take time and think about it. And it was so kind, you know, they gave me the time to sit and think and get my bearings and figure out how I could do it. And then, you know, I've talked about this, my friend Phil Rosenthal, who created Everybody Loves Raymond, really helped me, kind of pointed me in a new direction that would help me resurrect my spirit and my passion for making my show again.
Instead of coming up with the stories with Louis, you started a writer's room and hired women. Exclusively women?
No. It's interesting because the submissions I was getting were only women. You know, I was getting them from my network. I was getting them from my friends. And I said, hey, you know, my writing partner for the last 10 years has been a man. Please don't send me only women. So I read people and I ended up hiring two women and two men. And, you know, and I mean, I'd never been in a writer's room, let alone run a writer's room. I still don't know if I did it the right way, but I did it the only way I knew how to do it. And Phil was huge help. He helped coach me.
Your character on the show, again, a single mother of three, and in your series, the middle daughter almost bullies her mother, your character. And she's so, like, the children, the three children are, like, so not curious about their mother's life. You know?
And my God, that's amazing that you said that.
But they're not. They're really not. You know, like, you could be going through the most, like, extraordinary or excruciating thing, and it's like, they don't even want to know about it. And you could go out of your way to do, like, something great for, say, the middle daughter and get her tickets to something she's been dying to see.
Yeah.
And she'll just be rude to you about it. Or, like, so is that something that you've experienced? And how do you explain that? Because I know a lot of parents feel that way.
It's just, I'm so glad you brought it up, because it's just a very, you know, I describe it as being alone within the chaos. So they're all talking about their situations and everything, and I'm sitting there going, okay, well, I had, you know, this kind of really amazing thing happen today, or I feel bad about this, or I just went on a trip, I want to tell you guys about it. They really don't want to know. So it's like that thing when people say, when if a kid says to you, how was your day, it's shocking. You're stunned. Oh, my God. Thank you for asking. My day? Wait. Whoo. Be still, my heart. Let me take a seat. I mean, it's just, they are extremely self-absorbed. That's the way they are. They're you know, molding and changing, and they're losing their amniotic sacs daily and becoming, going in the direction of each other. And, you know, I remember when my kids were younger, one of my kids said something like, oh, you don't know who David Bowie is, Mom. And I was like, I will kill you, because I invented David. You don't tell me who David Bowie is. I told you. And it's you, there's this feeling of obsolescence when you have children who are, you know, gathering strength and momentum, and you're like, well, you guys pretty much don't need me anymore. You know, you're ready to go. It's a crazy kind of feeling. It's like, you know, you can be lonely and be living in a family, you know. I think it's particularly a single parent phenomenon.
But, you know, like your oldest, who's 22 now, I think, and who's...
She's 21, yeah.
21, and she has an acting career now, as does your middle daughter. But your oldest, who had moved out of the house, moved back in. So do you consider that a sign of your success or your failure? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, for me, it's a success. I love it. I mean, at a certain point, I had my three daughters and then two other kids living in the house up until a couple of months ago. And, you know, it's a happy place. You know, for me, I love to be home. I'm a homebody. When I'm not in production, I cook almost every single night. You know, and now my daughters are cooking. And it's extremely it's a success for me, except when they're bitchy, then I'm like, get out.
So when we started the interview, we played a clip from Better Things in which her character is telling her doctor that she needs something to help her sleep because one daughter's going through puberty, another is going to college, and your character has to pay tuition, and your character is going through menopause, and it's just like too much, and you can't sleep. So you yourself have been through a lot of that. Add on that you also went through the trauma of everything that happened with Louis. Are you getting any sleep?
I do get sleep. I sleep pretty good, I gotta tell you. I do the thing that I said in the scene with Dr. Babu. I don't sleep anymore. I pass out.
Well, good luck with the new season. Thank you so much for talking with us. I love talking with you.
Thank you so much, Terry, for having me. It was awesome to talk to you.
Pamela Adlon co-writes, directs, and stars in the FX comedy series Better Things. HBO is presenting a new two-part, four-hour documentary that already has generated controversy and a wide variety of reactions. It's called Leaving Neverland, and it's about two men in their 30s who give separate but similar and detailed accounts of being sexually abused as young children by music superstar Michael Jackson. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Leaving Neverland by documentary filmmaker Dan Reed is a tough TV show to watch. But it should be seen. Its central question is whether Michael Jackson used his fame and money to seduce young boys and their families into enabling a hidden pattern of serial pedophilia. That charge was denied strongly this week by members of the Jackson family, who have sued HBO for $100 million. They claim that the two men interviewed at the core of Leaving Neverland are only in it for the money from lawsuits and, before changing their stories, once defended Michael Jackson against similar charges in court, which they did. Wade Robson won first prize at a Michael Jackson imitation dance contest in Australia when he was 5, and soon ended up on stage a few nights during the real Jackson's tour for his album Bad, showing off his mini Michael dance moves. Another young boy, Jimmy Safechuck, was a Simi Valley kid who did some acting work in commercials, including, in 1986, a Pepsi commercial in which he meets Michael Jackson in his dressing room. When the superstar was accused and put on trial for charges of sexual abuse against minors, both Wade and Jimmy denied Jackson had done anything to them as young boys. In Leaving Neverland, they changed their stories and explained why. Throughout the 4 hours of this documentary, the now grown men give their accounts. So do their wives, their mothers, and their siblings, though almost never in the same camera frame. These families and their lives seem to be fractured, if not shattered, and the stories they tell go a long way towards explaining why. The documentary includes lots of corroborative evidence. Not of the sexual abuse, but of the undeniable closeness between Jackson and his much younger playmates. After Safechuck co-starred in that commercial, Jackson flew him and his family to a Pepsi convention. And in flight, Safechuck pretended to be a reporter and recorded a mock interview with his idol.
I remember the plane being quite empty. And I did this mock interview with him. He said I could ask him anything I wanted.
We're in the air, we're on our way home from Hawaii. thousands of feet in the air on this DC-10. And I've had a wonderful time with Jimmy.
Are you taping?
Sure. You can ask anything.
I was just playing reporter. And he never gave interviews. So it was kind of like, sure, you can interview me. But nobody else got interviews. So it was also a big deal.
How did you like Hawaii? What was your like best thing?
My best thing about Hawaii? Being with you.
How do you feel about performing and stuff? Do you like it?
I love performing. It is the greatest thing in the world because I feel at home on stage. I could live on stage. I'm the most happiest when I'm on stage and when I'm with Jimmy Safechuck. But the best commercial of all the Pepsi commercials is the one that you and I did. And I'm not just saying that. That's the best one. Because it has heart. Every time I see it, it makes me smile. And I hope to be you all's friends for a long time. Goodbye, signing off.
What at first appears innocent by the accounts of Safechuck and Robson soon turns sinister. At one point in Leaving Neverland, Safechuck displays for the camera a small box of rings he says were given to him by Jackson, including a diamond-encrusted wedding ring, in exchange for sexual favors. Safechuck's hand is shaking with emotion as he displays the rings and recounts his story. At another point in the documentary, Robson decides to go public with his claims of Jackson's pedophilia and ends up on the Today Show, interviewed by Matt Lauer.
Let me take you back to 2005, Wade, all right? The child molestation trial of Michael Jackson. You were the first witness called by the defense, and the attorney for Michael Jackson said he called you first because you were so convincing and powerful, asserting the innocence of Michael Jackson. Yeah. And here we are these years later, and you're going to say just the opposite.
Right.
What happened?
First of all, one thing I want to clear up is that this is not a case of repressed memory.
And it's been reported in the press some.
I never forgot one moment of what Michael did to me. But I was psychologically and emotionally completely unable and unwilling to understand that it was sexual abuse.
So what are you alleging that he actually did?
He sexually abused me from 7 years old until 14.
Leaving Neverland arrives on HBO at the same time Michael Cohen testified on live TV, accusing President Donald Trump of a variety of misdeeds. It arrives in the era of the Me Too movement, of the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination hearings, of rampant sexual child abuse in the Catholic Church, of charges of sexual misconduct by everyone from Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein to Louis C.K. and, yes, Matt Lauer. We seem to agree, as a country, that victims should be heard. But then what? Michael Jackson was a brilliant singer and performer and impacted so many lives that it's difficult to confront, much less accept, some of the charges in Leaving Neverland. And yet that star power, that magnetic talent, is what the men in the documentary say is precisely what entranced them and their families for so long and allowed the abuse to occur and remain hidden. The circumstances surrounding Michael Jackson and his relationships with young boys have always been questionable. But today's climate allows Leaving Neverland to ask questions at length and provide some answers. Me Too has taught us that alleged victims must be allowed to tell their stories. Leaving Neverland tells two of them, powerfully and unforgettably.
David Bianculli is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and author of The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. Coming up, we talk about the actual Green Book, the pre-civil rights era travel guide for African Americans, highlighting safe places to eat, stay, and do business. We'll hear from Yoruba Richin, the director of a new documentary about the Green Book. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The movie Green Book, which won 3 Oscars last Sunday, including Best Picture, takes its title from the pre-civil rights era travel guide for African Americans, listing places that were safe for them to eat, stay, and shop. We're going to talk about a new documentary called The Green Book, Guide to Freedom, which is airing on the Smithsonian Channel and streaming on various digital platforms. The Green Book was first printed in 1936 and stopped publication in 1967 after the signing of the Civil Rights Act. Our guest is the director of the documentary, Yoruba Richen. She tells the story through archival home movie footage and interviews with descendants of African Americans who used the Green Book and the children of business owners who were listed in the guide. The film shows the challenges and dangers Black travelers faced, the limited options they had while on the road, and the role business owners listed in the book played in the civil rights movement. Yoruba Richen is the director of the documentary program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. Her previous films include The New Black and Promised Land. Richen spoke to Fresh Air's Dave Davies about the Green Book.
Well, Yoruba Richen, welcome to Fresh Air. One of the things that makes the film so great is footage from the era and interviews from people who recalled these events. How'd you gather the material?
Well, in terms of the footage, we initially went down to the National African Museum of History in Washington, D.C. They are a Smithsonian partner. And as soon as I started to see this footage, this amazing home movie footage of African Americans traveling, vacationing, working, I wanted to tell the film through this archival footage. And I really wanted to have a home movie feel to it because that's what the Green Book was about. It was about African Americans traveling for, you know, vacation, for to visit family, and what their experience was like. And also the industry, the automobile industry, as we say in the film, was a huge employer of African Americans, helped us as we came out of the South from the Great Migration and get these jobs in these in the car factories, enter the middle class and the upper class. So the automobile is very significant for the African American population.
Well, let's talk a little bit about kind of what conditions were like that led to the need for the Green Book. And I want us to hear a little scene from the film where we hear two sisters reminiscing about traveling when they were kids. Their names are Jennifer Ivy and Karen Allen Baxter, who speaks first.
We would go places, and I remember the routine had been my dad would get out first, check it out, and we sat in the car. Then he would come out after a few minutes and say, okay, we can go in. But Jennifer reminded me of one time where we had reservations. Was it a hotel?
It was a hotel reservation, and when Daddy showed up, they said all of a sudden there was no reservation.
He got back in the car very quickly and was upset. It was because it was late at night and dark.
They sent us down the road someplace. I remember my mother being very upset. And we ended up in this hotel or motel that was a converted barn. And I remember Mommy saying it smelled like the animals were still there.
And it did.
And that's from the film The Green Book, A Guide to Freedom. Our guest is the director, Yoruba Richen. Just talk a bit about the challenges African Americans faced traveling back in those days.
You know, Karen and Jennifer are from New York. They traveled through New England with their family. And that instance happened when they were traveling to New England. And I say that because it's important to understand that this was not relegated to the Jim Crow South. The dangers and the humiliations and the fear were really all over the country. And in fact, in some ways, the South was a bit easier to navigate because there were signs. So you knew exactly where you could and couldn't go. Whereas in the North and the West, there weren't necessarily the signs, but still the same conditions. So African Americans had to figure out where they would go, where they would be able to sleep and where they would be served. And as you just heard, they would walk into places sometimes and would be denied. And then, of course, there's the danger, the potential threat of violence that met African Americans. There are places called sundown towns that are all over the country, mostly in the North and the West. And these were places that African Americans had to leave before the sun went down. Sometimes there were signs. Sometimes they rang a bell. So the workers who worked, the Black workers who worked there, knew they had to get out of the town. And these were all over the country.
Right. And it was really striking how many more sundown towns there were in the North and Midwest and West than in the Deep South. Why would that be?
You know, I think it's because the South had legal segregation. I mean, it was legal. And That's where, you know, obviously with the history of slavery and all that, there was a system that was set up to discriminate against African Americans. And in the North and the West, that system was not as sort of visible, even though it was still there. So I think that those sundown towns, I mean, there were, you know, they were all over. And that racism that was throughout the country, these were specific places where African Americans were either run out of the towns for various reasons, or they just never allowed African Americans to live in that town.
And these were places where African Americans worked during the day but had to...
Some, yes, mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, when a lot of us are on a road trip, you take for granted that when it's lunchtime, you know, you could find a restaurant, or maybe you want to grab some food to eat in the car or go to a grocery store and get stuff for a picnic. An African American family in this era faced a whole different challenges. They really had to think hard and prepare before they left, didn't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, at the screenings that we've had people stand up after the screenings and talk about how they remember, you know, their mom wrapping the fried chicken to bring on the road and the fruit that they would bring. And, you know, and they would just drive and not stop, or they knew only where to stop, specific places. We had one woman say, you know, she never knew why we only went to certain places. But, you know, as she got older, she knew that that was because they were using the Green Book. The family was using the Green Book and only going to the places that were designated. And they did. They had to prepare for these long journeys.
And there's the matter of using the bathroom. That's hard to plan. How did people figure out how to do that?
Well, a lot of times there were, you know, you use the Green Book to figure out where you could do that, where there were gas stations and restaurants. You had to go on the side of the road. I think that one of the things that is interesting is Rosa Parks, before she was, you know, the woman that we know who refused to give up her seat on the bus, she worked investigating harassment of African-American women in the South. And one of the places that African-American women were most vulnerable was on public transportation or on train stations, because they didn't have access to the facilities and had to go in the open sometimes. So this is a very deep reality that African Americans lived with, and a really big part of our experience that we don't talk about really when we talk about the Black experience. You know, we often have a very narrow lens in looking at African American history, and I think that the Green Book allows us to look at so much more.
Yeah, I think one of the men in the book said that when they would travel, he would bring a sheet in case they needed some kind of a screen or barrier, just so people
exactly.
could relieve themselves. Wow.
Exactly, exactly.
So how did the Green Book get started?
It was created by a man named Victor Green, Victor Hugo Green, first, you know, very good at branding, called the Green Book. And he was a postal worker based in Harlem. And he had a Jewish friend who had a guide to places in the Catskills where Jewish families could go and have recreation and pleasure and be safe. And he thought that would be a really good idea for African Americans. He knew that we needed such a guide. He also had a wife named Alma, and Alma had family in Virginia. And they would go and they'd travel from New York down to Virginia to visit family. So he experienced what it was like to drive on the segregated roads.
And how did he get the information for it? It's a big country. I mean, there was no internet, obviously, and people
right.
didn't call long distance routinely. How did he build his network?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty incredible, right? He did this all before computers. He was kind of one of the original crowdsourcers. He had a network of Black postal workers. And that was one of the industries, of course, where African Americans could break into the postal service. And he had a network of Black postal workers who he would get information from. So, you know, where are the Black businesses? Where are the Black communities? Let me know. And they also encouraged business owners to advertise in the book. So these postal workers would be out, you know, delivering mail, and they saw black businesses and they would tell them about the Green Book and encourage them to advertise in it. And then a little bit later, he would always say in the Green Book, like in the pages of the Green Book, he would always say, please send in your businesses. Sometimes he would target markets that he was looking for. Hey, we need more listings in, you know, Springfield, Missouri, or what have you. So, you know, it was a real early form of crowdsourcing. And of course, the distribution, he was able to partner with Esso Gas Station, and Esso distributed the Green Book in its gas stations.
Well, that's a big deal, because corporate America, we're not exactly open to, you know, black employment, certainly not black management back then.
Absolutely. So Esso is a really interesting case of how a corporation was really trying to be like on the progressive edge.
And we should probably just say for younger listeners, this is the parent company of what's now Exxon. So a big, huge oil company, right?
Yes. It was Standard Oil then. And it was owned by Rockefeller. Rockefeller was one of the owners. And Rockefeller was married to a woman. Her last name is Spellman. They were from a family of abolitionists. Spellman was, they started the HBCU, Spellman College in Atlanta, the Women's College. So there was a history of working to advance racial African-American rights that Rockefeller had. And he hired black chemists very early, or Esso did. They had they marketed to the African-American community. You know, they were also smart, and they knew that this was a potential customer base.
Right. So he began this in 1936 when, you know, the auto industry was booming and a lot of African-Americans got jobs and could afford cars and were traveling more. How did he market it? I guess the Esso gas stations were a good way.
Yep, Esso gas stations. He eventually printed around 15,000 copies. And somebody actually got up at one of my screenings, too, and said, you know what? It's also important to remember that not everybody bought a copy. They would share a copy. So they would pass it to their neighbor, to their family member who was traveling, you know, who was about to take a road trip. And I think it was word of mouth. And the businesses had them as well. And so I think it became that he distributed 15,000 copies. And because of the Esso connection, that really, you know, gave it a visibility that I think other travel guides didn't necessarily have. Because there were some other black travel guides, too. But the Green Book was the one that was the most well-known.
So it really was nationwide. It wasn't primarily in the Jim Crow South?
No, it was nationwide. I mean, Victor Green started in New York. He started with New York listings because there were places even in Harlem at the time that African-Americans were not allowed to go to. Even in the, you know, African-American Mecca, there was segregation, de facto segregation. So he started with New York listings, and then soon it went all over the country, really by the second or third edition. And then it was all over the world. By the end, he had incorporated Europe, Canada, Mexico, the Caribbean. And I think it's also important to know, too, that he started it as, it was called the Negro Motorist Guide. And then really by the early 1940s, he incorporated the Negro Motorist Guide to Travel and Vacation. So that's another part of it, too, that it was the guide helped African-Americans go to and find places where they could have vacation and leisure and recreation. So safety was a big part of it, obviously. But this pursuit of leisure and vacation was also a part of it.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about some of those resorts. But first of all, what other kinds of businesses were in it besides hotels and restaurants?
Gas stations were listed, clubs, liquor stores, resorts, beauty shops, tailors. In the early ones, there were doctor's office and hospitals. I mean, and that just goes to show you, as someone says in the film, the breadth of businesses and services that African Americans were locked out of at the time.
Right. And auto repair could be a big deal if you're on the road, too, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. If your car breaks down, we can't all, you know, not all of us know how to change a tire on the road. So auto repair and gas stations were definitely a big part of the Green Book.
You know, your film comes out the same year as the feature film Green Book, starring Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali, based on the story of Tony Vallelonga driving Don Shirley, the African-American pianist around the South. Have you seen the Green Book movie? The commercial
film?
Yeah. And your thoughts?
Before I saw it, I'd, you know, definitely had kept up with the sort of criticism it was getting around. Of course, it's winning a lot of awards, but the criticism it was getting from the family of Dr. Shirley, that this was, you know, a story told by the white driver's perspective, and that's certainly the case. It's not really, it's definitely through a certain lens that's the white driver's lens. But in terms of the Green Book, the thing that I found frustrating is that it only shows places that they go to, you know, through the Green Book as being really as dumps, as really not nice places. And that's not the case. There were so many, there were more than 9,500 listings in the book over the years. And places like the Gaston, which was considered the finest Negro motel in the country. So that was frustrating to see that portrayal of the Green Book in the film. And the other thing is that they only used it, they only picked up the Green Book when they were in the South. And that plays into the mythology that this was, you know, racism was something that was only in the South. So those are my two big criticisms in terms of, you know, how the Green Book was portrayed.
Well, Yoruba Richen, it's been great. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yoruba Richen directed the new documentary, The Green Book, Guide to Freedom. The film is being shown on the Smithsonian Channel and is streaming on various digital platforms. Her interview with Fresh Air's Dave Davies was recorded just before the feature film Green Book won the Oscar for Best Picture. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.